Chapter 2. All was well for John in his dual employment until the next morning when things went terribly wrong on the oil rig. The rising eastern sun painted the smooth surface of the Gulf waters a shimmering red, while John and Terrebonne waited on the supervisor to give them their order. Then here he came, his six-foot frame and visage gruff as usual. Two, the supervisor now brought a breeze with him that had just kicked up and began to ripple waters of the Gulf. A threatening cloud nearing the rising sun as the seagulls performed their early morning exercise, squawking here and there, waiting for some goody thrown to them. Filbert, John's pet seagull, remained in his roost and watched the other seagulls compete for an expected morsel. That had given John a sense of accomplishment in that he had a partially rehabilitated Filbert.
"Our job out here in the Gulf of Mexico is to drill for oil, not to feed the seagulls," John had heard the boss man say many times. Now he heard the raw bone boss give his most recent comment. "John, I gave your pet seagull a few grains of popcorn a moment ago. At heart, I'm really for the underdog, so to speak. That seagull would never have made it if you hadn't taken him in. He got hurt in that last storm that passed through right here before Rex Colbert got his leg mangled up. Right now, though, we need some cutting and welding done up there on the front side of the rig, muy pronto. See that steel flange? It needs a little work done on it. Up there about 30 feet, John heard the supervisor say and watched him point to the errant piece of metal. "This rig may have to ride out another storm before the week is over. The main body of that storm is coming across Dry Tortugas now. A news reporter said that a tour boat had been beached and the people aboard had taken refuge in the old wharf there. Bad situation. A reporter said that a seaplane had been flipped upside down and would have to be repaired before flying back to Key West. We want to be ready for it if it blows our way. So, John, get your helmet and tools and skinny up there and fix that steel rigging a little better. Won't take you long. Someone might get cut if they have to climb up there and fail to notice it. I remember one time I slid over a bolt sticking out of a beam and cut a hole in my leg," gruffly said the boss man. "Yes, sir, I'll take my helmet and cutting torch and hop right to it." That John did, and he waved to the new crane operator, Terrebonne, to lift him up above floor of the drilling rig. "We're so far out now that I can't see the tops of any of the shoreline buildings," hollered John when the crane leveled off near the steel that was to receive a little work done by John's cutting and welding skills. On past the oil rig, the red and yellow clouds contrasted with a dark blue haze dropping below the eastern horizon. The saltwater breeze ruffled the part from John's hair and caused a twisted tassel as he grabbed his helmet and cutting torch. Then he started sizing up exactly how he would handle the task before him. "Terrebonne, hold her steady. I think that I can repair that flange in about 10 minutes or so," hollered John from under the raised visor of his helmet and above the sound of the wind now picking up speed over the gulf.
"Okay, John, 30 feet isn't far above floor of the rig, but I don't know how high you'd bounce if you fell into that pile of steel girders over there,"
yelled back the crane operator to the tall, lithe young man now starting to step from the crane out onto side of the steel rig. Accidents always happen unexpectedly and in ways that it would sometimes be difficult to duplicate them. "I'll be careful," thought John. "I don't want to wind up like Rex," ran through his mind as he turned his head in time to see a gust of wind blow Mr. Terrebonne's paper lunch bag sideways. John saw Terrebonne hit the hydraulic release lever by mistake when trying to catch the moving bag. That mental and muscular miscue by Terrebonne dropped the crane and John LaRue with it, falling out of the bucket and onto the pile of steel girders, pointing in various directions. The fall cost John 2 broken bones, his left arm and left leg, not to mention lacerations to his head and neck. If that wasn't enough bad luck, John's own cutting torch got into the way, and he cut the right side of his face on the metal flange when he made an odd movement and his helmet came off. Luckily, Terrebonne and the supervisor quickly loaded John into the Shell Oil Company helicopter and whisked him away to the hospital to be stitched back together. 2 weeks within the Ochsner Medical Center in New Orleans gave John some downtime for mental reflection. What to do as far as a long-term profession? "I make good money on the oil rig. Trawling for shrimp with Dad and the family is a dream, but neither of these may last," thought John, as he now lay in the hospital bed while reading a copy of the Baton Rouge Advocate newspaper. Just then, the oil rig supervisor visited his hospital room. A Stetson cowboy hat well explained the personality of the man that wore it, for that man rode bucking bulls with the Professional Bull Riding Association until his mid-age. Then, with his reset bones, noticeable limp of his right leg, and a missing hand on end of his left arm, he became a Shell Oil Company supervisor. What kind of man is our supervisor? John LaRue was often asked by new roughnecks coming onto the oil rig for the first time. Our supervisor looks and walks like a hulking bouncer who has just cleared out the roughest joint on Bourbon Street. But he forgot to put his shirt tail back in and straighten his attire. His white cowboy hat, though, is always clean, straight, and pointed forward. No cocky side angle to it. The old man wouldn't hesitate one second to take on or talk down any dude who ever walked the streets of New Orleans at midnight begging for a fight, John told a recent chemist raised in Pangbourne, England, and assigned to the oil rig to assay raw petroleum brought up from the bottom of the Gulf. "So our boss is a ruffian fellow, hired because he's tougher than most other men," stated the new chemist, trying to figure out where he'd fit into this unique conglomeration of men employed to reap raw petroleum from below surface water of the Gulf of Mexico. "Yes, and he's also a graduate chemical engineer from LSU," had said John to the chemist later. "John, I hope that you're able to get back to work soon. You're the best welder that we have. Your backup just doesn't have the skills that we need for some of the tougher jobs," he heard his supervisor say when at the same time a nurse dressed in purple sweatpants with a gold stripe running down each leg, showing her LSU loyalty, entered the room. She carried a food tray emitting sumptuous odors from South Louisiana. "Sir, you may sit here and watch John sip some turtle soup through this straw," said the brunette beauty, showing concern for John, still with some bandages taped to the right side of his face. "After he finishes his meal, I've got to change the gauze on his wounds." Upon hearing the nurse's kind but direct comments, John looked forward to the food, but not the bandage change, because his facial cheek was still tender. "John, with the best that we can do, you're still going to have a scar on your right cheekbone," had said the doctor 1 week after Terrebonne's lunch bag missed the pile of steel girders, but John didn't. "Yes, ma'am. I'll help take care of John. We need him back out in the Gulf soon as you and the doctors get him back up and running," John heard from the man who helped draw up oil lying below floor of the Gulf. Depending upon lengths and configurations of the carbon chains and benzene rings, products such as gasoline and asphalt would be made by petroleum companies and sold to the public. "John is going to be with us for a few more days. His next stop will be physical therapy to strengthen his arm and leg," said the nurse, now placing John's food tray for his ease of reaching. A cup bearing a small portion of shrimp gumbo accompanied the turtle soup, toast, and black Louisiane coffee on John's food tray. He emptied those ceramic containers and knew that he was on the mend. Then John heard some more good news brought on by his irregular eating schedule caused by surgical requirements. "In about an hour, I'll bring you a large bowl of shrimp and grits," said the immaculately dressed nurse as she lifted the food tray from John's bed and graciously headed toward the door, leading to the long corridor of the hospital. "How lucky can one Cajun be?" drawled John through the new bandages affecting his speech pattern. And he waved a gentle goodbye to the nurse and gave a prophetic statement. "Shrimp and grits have got great healing powers." John, wanting to be fair to the oil company that had permitted him to save several thousand dollars, now addressed his supervisor sitting beside the bed. "Mr. Bordeaux, I hate to tell you this, but I've decided that I'm going to change my work career. I'm quitting the oil rig." George Boudreau had the responsibility of keeping a drill bit going ever downward as the oil company searched for new deposits of oil within the Gulf of Mexico. To lose good technicians, engineers, and metal workers always posed the possibility of causing more mishaps on an oil rig. The crane operator who had dropped John was still in training. "John, if that's your final decision, do you care to tell me why you're hanging up your welding helmet?" His question was firm and to the point. "Did any dissension with other men working on the rig have anything to do with your decision to quit?" asked Mr. Bordreau. "You're a gentle soul, but I know that you take no gruff when attacked. I figured that out about a year ago when a pickpocket tried to pick your pocket. The cops came a little late to separate the two of you, and then an ambulance came to pick up the pickpocket lying inert in the gutter. No, George, I got along well with all of my roughneck buddies. I've been lying here reassessing my life. I'm 25. And an iron worker with only a high school education. I plan on going to college. You know, too, that I'm a shrimper during my off time. One of these days, those two jobs, which I love, may for whatever reason come to an end. In my case now, I'm pretty broken up. Doctors tell me I'll walk with a limp and have a scar on the right side of my face. Surgeons, though, are trying to salvage as much of my good looks as they can.
And he gave a laugh that could be heard out into the hospital corridor, because he never thought of himself as good-looking, because he bore a broken nose from his running track days when he'd just beaten an opponent in a mile run. The guy was a poor loser, minus one front tooth after the scuffle that we had. "He had blindsided me with a sucker punch," had said John to his track coach. John had mixed emotions over everything that he'd just said, because he knew that he was giving up good money by quitting the oil rig. Furthermore, he knew that he would miss the camaraderie of his roughneck buddies as they searched for raw petroleum beneath the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. George Boudreau, without saying further words for the present moment, now just sat silently within the beige-colored hospital chair that complemented the blue paint on the walls of the room. He well understood John's aspirations for a college degree, but he also knew that the loss of highly trained metal workers could set up dangerous situations on an oil rig stuck out into the Gulf of Mexico. As the oil rig supervisor started to ask John what he intended to major in at college, a male nurse leading a border collie, a black and white 3-year-old dog, entered the door to John's hospital room.
"Hello, John. I'm Michael Guidry. This is Good Boy, our comfort dog. Professionally, we think that most patients derive pleasure, which promotes healing while in a hospital, by enjoying a visit from a loving dog. So 3 years ago, I donated my own dog for the treatment of our patients. The hospital CEO agreed. So here we are, Michael and Good Boy," said the nurse. The border collie gently wagged his tail and stood beside Michael. Then Michael spoke to the dog. "Go see John," and Michael gave the dog a pat on its back. John watched Good Boy come directly to the hospital bed, and then he felt the long pink tongue of Good Boy touch his hand sticking out of the cast on his left arm. "Good Boy, why don't you go see Mr. Boudreau first? He's older than I am. You should show reverence to the elderly," said John, and he gave another hearty laugh and winked toward the oil rig supervisor. The border collie responded to John's question by wagging his tail faster. Good Boy's tail ended in a 3-inch tip of white hair whisking against the sheet covering John's injured leg, protruding at an angle a little out of the bed. Mr. Boudreau, not to be good-naturedly outgunned by John, gave a hushed request to Good Boy. "Come here, Good Boy. Come and see me." Good Boy left side of the bed and came to the chair of George Boudreau. The oil rig supervisor with his good right hand gave a pat to the top of the dog's head and then watched as the dog did a tail wag and returned to the bed of John. "This loyal dog," said George, and laughed along with the other two men.
"Fellows, I've raised this border collie from a pup. In our comfort dog program, we teach the dogs to always approach bed of the patient first. It's common that any visitors to the patient's room will naturally talk to the dog. Our therapy dogs are trained to acknowledge the visitor, but then return to the patient. We believe that this arrangement helps to bond the patient, visitors, and dog in a positive relationship," John heard Nurse Guidry say, and he agreed that all made sense. John, drawn to the friendship of dogs, especially his duck dog and rabbit dog, knew that each breed differed in how they bonded to humans. Thus, he inquired to the male nurse, "Michael, how did your border collie wind up with the name of Good Boy?"
"It happened naturally. When he was only a few days old, I called him Captain. He seemed to have a strong personality and be in charge. I thought that should go over well in our comfort dog program. But from the start, when the dog came alongside a patient's bed, the typical response was a pat on the dog's head and a verbal response of Good Boy. It only seemed logical that we change Captain to Good Boy. The amazing thing is, I think that the border collie likes the name change. The Good Boy name coming from most of the patients has strongly bonded him."
"Does Good Boy have any bad characteristics?" asked the oil rig supervisor. And John observed the smile upon his boss's face. He had always enjoyed Boudreau's sense of humor. Even when he had told the drilling crew how he'd lost his left hand to a drill bit in trying to save the company money when the bit had gotten lodged into the tube and he used his left hand instead of a steel probe. Then John heard a maxim that he'd always thought well of, a natural response of the human heart.
"I wouldn't call it a bad or negative characteristic, but I can tell that Good Boy is just naturally drawn to the affection of children. I think, though, that's because he and the children are young animals, both liking to play and agile enough to do so. What I'm saying is, I think that's just a common response of dogs," said Michael Guidry.
Now, suddenly, through the open hospital door to John's room came the barely audible words of a doctor. "Nurse, that 10-year-old lad is scheduled for his treatment at 2:30. I feel so sorry for that kid. I wish we could calm him down some way other than through medication. But I know that he's now feeling a lot of pain from that snake bite."
"How did he get the snake bite?" asked the nurse. He chose the collection of three turtles as his science project in school, said the 40-year-old doctor with a stethoscope dangling below his blonde hair and an ink pen in his left pocket of his white coat.
So he accidentally got snake bitten, said the nurse as she made preparation for the anti-venom application.
I guess all snake bites are accidental, though, even to trained herpetologists.
Yes, he said that a copperhead snake lay near the land terrapin, and he didn't see it until it bit him.
When was he bitten? Anti-venom should be applied within 30 minutes following a bite, said the nurse. And if constrictor snakes ever do get into Atchafalaya River Basin, we'll have different types of injuries to deal with.
He was bitten about 30 minutes ago. He had his collection bag while he walked near the Atchafalaya River Basin, said the doctor.
He got here pretty quick, said the nurse. But we better get the anti-venom into him soon as possible.
I reckon so. He told me that a college student brought him in a truck. We've got to start the anti-venom soon as the medical helicopter gets here from Tulane. They had some anti-venom for copperhead bites in stock. We didn't, and that's too bad. Take a note and tell our pharmacy downstairs to check their supply of anti-venom for the four poisonous snakes in this area, said the doctor. John LaRue had a strong emotional feeling for children and felt sorry for the youngster bitten by a copperhead snake. Then he saw Nurse Goodry and Good Boy quietly leave the room. Nurse Goodry gave a goodbye wave with his right hand and pointed down the hall where the little boy screamed louder through both fright and pain. The youngster knew that the anti-venom shots would hurt, and he feared the breathing tubes that would be placed in him.
George, it's too bad that boy has been bitten by a copperhead, said John to his oil rig supervisor.
It happens every summer around here. Children playing outside down near the swamps are the most likely to encounter poisonous snakes, said George.
And his demeanor became more serious as he recalled the close call that his daughter had at summer camp near Lake Charles 2 summers earlier when a copperhead snake bit through his daughter's left tennis shoe. Within 5 minutes, the young lad's concern subsided into low-sounding pleading.
Oh, please let Good Boy go with me to the operating room, please.
John LaRue knew what was happening in room 6, and so did George Boudreaux.
You can't separate a kid from a loving dog, said John, and he saw the smile upon the tan face of Mr. Boudreaux, and knew that it came from heartfelt emotion toward that of a youngster aided by a border collie.
Then, without any announcement of such, Michael Goodry quickly stuck his head through the door and made an announcement.
John, Good Boy and I will see you tomorrow. We're now headed to the operating station to help a kid get over a snake bite.
Nurse Goodry left in a hurry with Good Boy, hard upon his heels. They hurried to catch a gurney, wheeling the lad toward the elevator down the corridor. Both men sat quietly for a couple of minutes. Then, in a softly spoken voice from 8 feet distance, George Boudreaux spoke.
John, I'm headed down to the helipad and calling the company helicopter that carries roughnecks back out to the drilling platform.
Hope you mend real soon, and I'll watch after your pet seagull until you come and tidy up your business with Shell. I suppose you'll want to take Filbert with you when you leave.
Yes, I do. I never thought that I'd get so attached to a seagull. Also, to better let you know where I'm coming from as far as my college field of study.
Major, I guess that I should call it. About all that I can tell you is that I want some kind of an outdoor job. I don't know exactly what that may turn out to be. I don't think that I could stand being cooped up inside a building the rest of my life.
I hate to lose you, John, but I agree with what you're telling me, and I think that you will do well in college.
Come back to the oil rig, and we'll tidy up your departure business as soon as you're well enough to do so, said George, as he extended his right hand to John and received a firm commitment back.
Boudreaux's left shirt sleeve of his tan shirt moved oddly vacant.
With the uncertainty that may come from making a tough decision, John lay flat upon his back and looked upward to the ceiling of the room toward the fluorescent light above him without really seeing it. He was thinking of something else.
I'll miss the camaraderie in transitioning from an oil rig roughneck to that of a college student. But the time has come for me to get a college education, he thought. 5 minutes had elapsed since Goodry and the border collie passed by out in the corridor. Then a nurse popped through the door.
John, here's that large bowl of shrimp and grits that I promised you a while ago. The dietitian in the kitchen said that this nourishment should help any wounded Cajun to heal.
After the nurse helped John get his bowl of shrimp and grits arranged upon his eating tray, she turned toward the door.
John, I'm going off duty, but another nurse will pick up your tray after you finish. I'll close the door while you're having your lunch.
As the nurse left John's room, the happy bark of a border collie entered from the hospital corridor. It didn't take John long to empty the bowl of shrimp and grits. That done, he thought what he should do when released from the hospital. For my own financial security, I sure don't intend to squander the savings that I've made with the oil company.
I'll try to buy some land at a fair price. That will at least hold my investment and maybe increase it, he thought. They're not making any more land in the southeast as more industry is coming this way. The remainder of my money I'll leave in a savings account in Baton Rouge, where I do my banking.